Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. We're going to go now to Framingham, where city officials are confirming to Radio Boston that they have successfully trapped and killed beavers in two locations where their dams caused water to flood and freeze on roads, posing a public safety threat. And because state law prohibits transporting beavers to different locations, the city says they had no choice but to set lethal traps. Joining us now on the line to talk about this is Jeff Collins. He's the director of conservation science for Mass Audubon. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Jamie. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
So first, you know, this story has kind of developed through the day. We just confirmed here on our show that these beavers have been killed. So what's your reaction to that news?
Well, I think, first off, Framingham, I'm sure, is not alone in facing this issue. We've worked with folks in Framingham on their conservation commission and their staff there, and they're good people. They've partnered with us on conservation issues, and I think that a lot of towns are going to be facing this situation where you have a sort of a short-term public safety issue, but there's a need to look at longer-term solutions to addressing conflicts with beavers, flooding, and other wildlife.
So these were real issues that Framingham was facing, and I think it's easy to feel for the animals, but it's also we should feel for the people too. They were trying to figure out what the best thing was to do for their city. So have they solved the problem by killing these beavers?
In the short term, I think they'll be able to drain, the wetland or lower the wetland to relieve flooding on that road, et cetera. But the beavers were there because it was attractive habitat for them. So in short order, other beavers will be back. Beavers reproduce. The young eventually move off and find their own habitat. And someone will be back rebuilding that dam pretty soon. And so that raises the need to use other methods to coexist with wildlife. And in the case of beavers, on Mass Audubon Wildlife Sanctuaries, we've used a device called a beaver deceiver, and this has been successful in a lot of other places.
What's a beaver deceiver?
You basically put a pipe through the dam, and then you block off the inlet of that pipe so that the beavers can't figure out where the dam is leaking, and they won't go back and close up the pipe. So beavers will respond to the sound of flowing water. They'll just instinctively pull over some sticks and material and mud, block that up, slow down the flow, and build up their pond. So if you can basically secretly and quietly punch a hole in the dam, sometimes they can't quite figure it out. Those devices, there's some cost involved planning.
Yeah, I mean, how much does something like that cost to do?
Some maintenance, but they're successful.
How much does a beaver deceiver, is that really the name of it? It sounds interesting.
I think it's a capital B, capital B. I think there's a
product. Oh, so it's a company. Okay.
Beaver deceiver, but there are others, you can come up with a similar device. Cost-wise.
Yeah, how much does something like that cost? Yeah.
Staffing, et cetera, probably in the thousands of dollars. I think the situation in Framingham was it was a time issue probably more than a resource issue.
Yeah, and the city of Framingham actually said that to us in a statement. They said, at this point, due to the extreme elevation of the water, it was too late to implement that option. But so putting the beaver deceiver or other similar devices aside, were there other ways that the city could have dealt with this? We were reading that it's against state law to move beavers. Why is that?
That's right. Yeah, it's not only the case in Massachusetts, and that law has been in place for a long time. I think the concern there is that you are, you're moving wildlife. You could be spreading disease or parasites to other populations. You're sort of dropping off this one animal where there's other animals already present, leading to conflicts. You drop, kick that animal out of the back of the car, and then it's a stranger in a new land. It doesn't know what to do, where to go. It's not very kind to that animal. And you're not dealing with a problem, as we just talked about. You're making it someone else's problem, potentially. So you can not relocate animals off of your own property.
Got it. So, okay, one other question on this before we run out of time here. Are there other species that maybe could be introduced to the area, or other environmental things that could be done in Framingham, other towns, to help control the beaver population?
Beavers are so successful because they've got a great strategy figured out. They make their pond, mm-hmm. they stay in the water, they get their food in the now flooded area, and they were successful even in the age of our big predators, wolves and mountain lions. But you know, they had a strategy that protected them. So they don't really have effective predators at this point. I will just finally say, if I have time, to say this is an issue that's going to be more common, I think, in an era of climate change. We're going to have more precipitation, uh-huh. more intense rain events, and beaver dams and other wetlands are actually acting as sponges, absorbing that stormwater.
So they're important to the ecosystem.
They're important, and I think they're going to be more important going forward.
All right. Well, we'll keep on this one. Jeff Collins is the Director of Conservation Science for Mass Audubon. Jeff, thanks for helping us make a little bit more sense of what happened in Framingham.
Good to talk to you, Jamie.
It was a lunchtime argument among East Boston high school students that quickly fizzled. But what transpired in the cafeteria that day set a series of actions in motion, and 3 years later, the repercussions are still unfolding. WBUR's Shannon Dooling brings us this report, Observations of a Seemingly Mundane High School Argument That Can Have a Profound Impact in the Hands of Federal Immigration Officials. Her story begins in El Salvador.
The small city of Metepan is about a two-hour drive from the Salvadoran capital of San Salvador. It's close to the border with Guatemala. This is where we meet 22-year-old Orlando. It's a hot and humid afternoon, and he wipes sweat from his forehead every now and then. He says it's safer for us to talk at the plaza instead of meeting him at his grandparents' house.
So you've been back here since January. What is life like here?
Life here is really hard. I can't find a job here. There's nothing. It's really dangerous. There's too much death here and fear. There's a lot of fear.
We've agreed to use only his middle name. Orlando fears for his safety in El Salvador and for the safety of his grandparents. Orlando was born in Metepan, but it's never really felt like home. He says he was abandoned by his mother when he was younger and was more or less raising himself much of his life. And that's why he decided to find his dad. He was 17 when he started the journey alone, heading north toward the U.S.-Mexico border and ultimately East Boston.
It was awful. I had to travel by land, and it was hard. There was a lot of suffering. I was mistreated a lot along the way.
He says he was kidnapped in Mexico and held hostage for almost a month before he escaped, illegally crossing the border near McAllen, Texas. He arrived as an unaccompanied minor in 2014 and was released to his father in Boston. He obtained a special immigrant juvenile visa and applied for a green card. He was working and going to school. He says he felt safe in Boston.
I don't know. I guess I got used to being with my family. That's what I wanted the most.
And then, in 2015, on a Thursday afternoon in November, all of that changed.
So as you can see, there's a number of files and folders. You can also see FedEx envelopes that included filings to the Board of Immigration Appeals.
Sarah Sherman Stokes opens the top drawer of a filing cabinet in her Boston University Law School office. Sherman Stokes represented Orlando in his immigration proceedings. She thumbs through dozens of folders, all related to Orlando's case.
I mean, it does feel in some ways like this sort of tomb where all the papers came to die.
Two of these papers, an incident report filed by an East Boston high school police officer, triggered what comes next. The report cited what began as a few students heckling another student in a classroom. The class dismisses and moves into the cafeteria for lunch, at which point a few of the students confront one another. What follows is described in the report as an unsuccessful attempt at starting a fight. One student is cited as saying he heard from friends that some of the young people involved might be part of a gang. According to the report, school police officers reviewed security camera footage. Orlando was identified as one of the students involved. In the report, he's listed as an associate of the gang MS-13. The incident description ends stating, quote, "This incident will also be sent to the BRIC." That's the Boston Regional Intelligence Center. It's a unit of the Boston Police Department that gathers and analyzes intelligence, which is shared with federal law enforcement. 9 months later, Orlando was getting ready to go to work at a nearby Mexican restaurant when he was arrested at his father's home by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. That two-page school incident report had made its way into what's known as a gang packet, information compiled by Homeland Security Investigations, or HSI. It's unclear how, but Orlando allegedly evolved, in the eyes of authorities, into a verified and active member of MS-13. Those were the classifications printed in all capital letters on the first page of the government's gang packet. Here's Sherman Stokes.
The maker of this report is usually a special agent from HSI, and that person's usually not available in court to be cross-examined. One of the problems here is it's a black box. You know, it's not clear to us how this determination that the client is a verified and active member of a street gang, how is that determination made?
The government's case also included pictures printed off Orlando's Facebook account. Handwritten notes in the margins and arrows point to details like blue shoelaces and a Chicago Bulls hat as alleged proof of MS-13 affiliation. Orlando, for his part, insists he was never involved with the gang. Sherman Stokes says he has no criminal record. Around this time, East Boston and neighboring communities were experiencing a spike in violent crimes, believed to be associated with organized gang activity. Many of the victims were young men of Central American backgrounds. In January 2016, federal, state, and local law enforcement made arrests throughout Greater Boston, leading to a sweeping indictment of more than 60 alleged MS-13 members and associates. Just last month, one of the members was sentenced to life in connection with the killings of two teenagers in East Boston. The victims had been stabbed dozens of times. Orlando's school incident report was sent to the BRIC by a Boston school police sergeant. According to a transcript of immigration court testimony, the officer says he received no specialized training in identifying gang activity, but has learned how to identify gang behavior after years on the job. He goes on to testify that keeping track of gang behavior is a big part of his duties at East Boston High School. School police officers are employees of Boston Public Schools, not the Boston Police Department. In an email, a Boston Public Schools spokesman said the Boston Police Department provides regular training to school police officers on gang activity. Thomas Nolan is a former Boston Police gang detective and a professor of criminology. He says he's concerned Boston school police officers are performing more like Boston police, but without the proper training.
Boston school police are putting in information into the BRIC database that's oftentimes not only inaccurate, but they're exceeding the bounds of their authority.
Nolan also worked for the Department of Homeland Security, the federal agency overseeing regional intelligence centers like the BRIC. He's traveled around the country training law enforcement on the kind of information that should be shared in these databases. We showed him the school incident report alleging Orlando's gang association and describing the incident in the cafeteria.
Well, someone receiving this kind of information at the BRIC needs to make an assessment as to whether or not this is appropriately included in the criminal intelligence database. And if this was something that I saw, I would never put this into a criminal intelligence database.
The Boston Police Department did not respond to requests for comment. Some Boston school police have exercised their authority off school property, which, according to Boston Public School officials, is beyond school police jurisdiction. Six students listed in a Boston School Police intelligence report obtained by WBUR were stopped and frisked in 2017 by Boston school police at a dog park in East Boston. The intelligence report was included in one of the federal government's gang packets. It was filed by the same sergeant who alleged Orlando was a gang associate. Nolan now does some work as an analyst, evaluating information for immigration attorneys whose clients have gang packets. He questions whether city leaders are fully aware of the way information flows between Boston school police and federal immigration officials.
This city, Boston, represents itself as a sanctuary city. It certainly conveys the idea that its law enforcement agency will not cooperate and facilitate deportations and ICE detentions, when in fact the Boston Regional Intelligence Center is doing just that.
WBUR submitted repeated public information requests to Boston Public Schools, asking for details about training for school police and other incident reports that included gang allegations. Despite winning an appeal from the state records office, WBUR received a response from the city of Boston saying the records are part of active litigation and would not be made available. The ACLU of Massachusetts recently sued the Boston Police Department, asking for access to the gang database and citing an uptick in gang allegations being used to keep people in detention and, in some cases, as a basis for deportation. After spending more than a year detained in immigration custody in Boston, Orlando signed his own deportation letter in 2017 against the advice of his lawyer. He says he was too depressed to wait out the appeals process behind bars. Sitting in Metepan, Orlando stares out into the plaza, reflecting on his life in Boston.
Working and studying and everything. I was doing all that when they grabbed me. My life was ruined. And truthfully, I don't know if I'm ever going to have another opportunity like that.
Orlando is still adjusting to his surroundings in El Salvador. He's looking for work, but says he spends most days in the house, just sort of passing time.
That report from WBUR's Shannon Dooling. Stay with us. There's more Radio Boston after the break. I'm Jamie Bologna.